This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. In July of this year, I aired the wonderful book-length poem Whale Nation, written and performed by British poet Hethcote Williams. Williams wrote another book-length poem about a large mammal, this time the largest land-living mammal, the elephant, called Sacred Elephant. On tonight's Word Temple, I'll play a recording of Williams performing that poem, which, although it has not received quite the critical acclaim that Whale Nation received, still deserves our close attention. Williams's poem moves through the life of elephants in their natural habitat, but doesn't spare us from the horrors of their lives in captivity. As he did with Whale Nation, he underscores the poem with classical music. Before playing Sacred Elephant, here's a song by South African singer Miriam Makeba.
Bacheni ngankomi kwaZulu
ngoba ngkome mapatheni
ngankomi kwaZulu
ngankome mapatheni
ngomi kwaZulu
abankome mapatheni
ngankomi kwaZulu
ngankome mapatheni
ngomi kwaZulu
abankome mapatheni
ngankomi kwaZulu
ngankome mapatheni
ngomi kwaZulu
abankome mapatheni
ngikome kwaZulu
yelela ngikome mapatheni
ngikome kwaZulu
abankome mapatheni
kweke ngiye kwaZulu kwafelu
kweke ngiye kwaZulu kwafelu
bathi kweke ngiye kwaZulu kwafelu
kweke ngiye kwaZulu kwafelu
Sacred Elephant by Hethcote Williams. The shape of an African elephant's ear is the shape of Africa. The shape of an Indian elephant's ear is the shape of India. As if nature had kept an ear to the ground when listening to the elephant's territorial requests. There are few such striking simulacra giving human beings a poetic license to the landscape, save perhaps Italy, shaped like a wizened jackboot. Brahma concealed in each of the animals a profound secret. The secret of the mystic syllables, Amsvara, he concealed in the horse. The secret of internality in the cow, the secret of prophecy in the chameleon, the secret of longevity in the crow. In the elephant, a beast of the moon with crescent tusks who has emerged from the churning of the seas. He said he had concealed wisdom. The elephant now has a depleted population the size of Wilsdon, and we are not wise. It hasn't been for want of good public relations. Alexander the Great chose the elephant as a symbol of might. Minerva, the goddess of wisdom, had the head of an elephant towering above her own, and elephants pulling her chariots of knowledge. To the early Christians, the elephant was the bearer of all infirmities, and Lord Protector, treading serpents underfoot. In China, the elephant, Da Qiang, was a beast with power over nature. The tantric monk Pu Kong in the 8th century joined in meditation with elephants to shift clouds, commenting, "It is easy with such allies to procure rain or sunshine, though still difficult to rid the country of evildoers." The Romans believed the elephant was a religious animal. Pliny observed it, worshipping the sun and stars and purifying itself at the new moon, bathing in the river and invoking the heavens. The Romans have departed, but the elephant still stands in introspective silence at sunrise and at sunset, as if in prayer. In Hinduism, the elephant mounts a tortoise to support a vessel which holds a lotus, an indication of the Heath Robinson route we may all take to ecstasy. And if man is made in an image of a god, then the hathi, the elephant, is made only in the image of an animal. On the night of the birth of the Buddha, an elephant entered the dreams of Queen Mahamaya, his mother, and Gautama Buddha was consequently patient, strong, meek, and unforgetful. But when it was thought the elephant could best be experienced by putting it into a forced labor camp, or by killing it, and packaging bits of it as billiard balls, umbrella stands, rosary beads, and bookends in its own image, then it became geared to the mass market, which has seen fit to reduce it to a bowdlerized Dumbo Jumbo, a performing slave in a designer cage. With its tusks sawn off, and a ring through a piece of flesh, sensitive enough to read Braille, Eliphas Maximus, Loxodonta Africana, Eliphas Indicus, to give its names in the forensic fossil language of postmortems. Nature's blasting, billowing archangel, a land manatee, a land siren, a land whale. The oldest and largest of land mammals, was born in the late Ice Age, when we were only a glint in Darwin's eye. The elephant moves slowly to protect its vast brain, with which it hears subsonic sound, and in which it carries the topology, the resonances and reverberations of a continent. To the elephant, our scrap of consciousness may seem as inconsequential as a space invader blip. The elephant can walk on the tips of its toes along mountain paths that are near vertical. It can move in silence without leaving a trace, and is unembarrassed by its bulk. Though it moves at a stately pace, it can sprint faster than any human, 30 to 40 miles an hour, yet never travels so fast that it loses track of itself. It takes 2.5 days to digest its food. It washes, massages, and powders its quilted skin with fine dust daily. Its surface muscles are so cunningly tuned that they can crush a colony of hematomyces, elephant lice, with one focused ripple. Human beings, similarly infested, can only bleat to ICI. With its ears, it can discern a mouse, which is reassuring for mice. And while our ears are addicted to noise, thrice-chewed auditory gum, the elephant's huge sounding boards open and close like eyelids, excluding debilitating junk with an enshrouding Trappist blink. With them, it fans its whole body, cooling the blood by filtering it through needle-thin vessels, sailing calmly through any climate. The trunk, through which it breathes, the nose and upper lip, the ringed proboscis with 60,000 muscles, has nothing to do with baggage. From tromp, trumpet, because that is what the rhythmic rush of air up and down it sounds like. When it is not humming, or roaring, or piping, or talking, or purring, or rumbling, or sneezing, the trunk can stun a dog with a sneeze. The Aryans of the first millennium called the elephant Mrigi Hastin, the beast with a head finger. And with it, an elephant can remove a thorn or pick up a pin, uncork a bottle, pull up a tree by its roots, detect tripwires and traps, doodle in the sand, douse for water underground, walk along riverbeds, swim across inland oceans, and sense alien presences many miles away. The trunk is a 6-foot-long, 1-foot-thick third eye. No occultist's conceit, without which the elephant would starve. When in pairs, elephants slowly snake their trunks across each other's faces to read the chemical language exuding from must glands in their cheeks. Then they stop, waveringly. The tips hover and are cupped against the skin upon the forehead, as if picking up signals from within. Then their trunks are disconnected and wreathed together in a loving knot. Elephants' foreplay can last 3 days. And that's very heavy petting. They can show affection without being instantly possessed by a desire to get their rocks off on the spot. And their rocks are no smarties. One aberrant jet of elephant sperm will feed a 40-foot-high anthill for a year. Pregnancy lasts 2 years, which suggests that they've given it a thought. There seems to be no need for the ultrasonic scanners, neurotically poking at a fetus half-pickled in food preservative, or the epidurals, or the monitoring devices of those who've lost touch with their far smaller bodies. Their antenatal care is carefree. An elephant's birth is attended by a midwife in the center of a protective circle. The baby's first sight is of its placental membrane being tweaked into the air and flipped away in triumphant relief like a giant flailing frisbee. elephant's child, enters a matriarchal communalist society with breast milk available at every street corner. A herd of 500 elephants is a mobile creche and an old people's home, where each elephant knows every fellow member by what it is that we glibly call name. And an elephant can detect fellow members of its tribe from a distance of 10 miles, human beings from only 2 miles, which makes the human aura 8 miles weaker. Elephants' tusks, their swords, are used mainly as plowshares, for breaking up chosen scraps of earth to eat and cure themselves of internal parasites, for digging wells, for finding salts and mineral crystals to fuel the brain, for gathering food. Neither the cruise missile nor the trident is capable of doubling up as a cocktail stick. The adrenaline of one herd would keep a small war in the Middle East going for a month. Elephants just dip into it occasionally to adjust the fine tuning within the community. Despite the invisible intricacies of elephant society, some would cast them all as rogues, judging them by the notoriety of one. Every culture has its lone delinquents. But should you be regarded as psychotic simply because you have toothache or because you're a male in must, forcibly transported to a country with no female elephants for 500 miles, nor any for the rest of your life? In the wild, almost all rogues are turned mad, blinded by tea planters' grape shot, pockmarked with septicemic sores from crossbow bolts dunked in battery acid, or chronically disturbed by a bullet embedded in the skull. If you had roamed every continent for thousands of years, coming to consider the globe your own private football, and you were then confined to an open prison, a tourist-infested allotment in the suburbs of Nairobi on emergency rations, you too might become unbalanced. Rogue or sane, elephants are mowed down without discrimination in an imperious cull by the bureaucrats of ecology, who see fit to pass judgment on them for ruining their own landscape. Though elephants have felled favored baobabs since antiquity, preferring the juicy core rich in calcium to rummaging through safari lodge dustbins. The Nandi and the Maasai know the elephant as a survivor from an older order and defer to its seniority in matters of land tenure. Now, the domain of the elephants is laid waste by urban encroachment, and their diet whittled down from 50 different fruits in their ancestral Eden to parched grass and human refuse. Accordingly, they have begun to postpone puberty, lengthen the intervals between calving, to slow down their breeding and match their population to the arid nutrients that remain. Yet, conservationists presumptuously ignore the change, and as the elephant makes its own biological adjustments, the oldest and wisest members of the herd, who know their habitat far better than their killers ever could, who know the ranges, the sources of food and water, the salt licks, the signs of an enemy, are executed, leaving the herd to flounder and disperse. Victims of military calculations of their own land's carrying capacity. Their murder is described as a sampling. The elephant is shat upon with greater honesty by vultures. Industrialists, who turn the Amazonian jungle into useless tundra, or cement over half the planet, are not, for some reason, machine-gunned en masse, nor captured and exhibited, nor do they have their teeth extracted and carved into little men. Of course, animals don't know what is happening to them. They are spared our strong emotions. Yet elephants will place their trunks into the mouths of injured companions, nudge and nurse the wounded to their feet, knowing that their weight may press down fatally upon their lungs. They will cake each other's wounds with a styptic clay to staunch the flow of blood. They have been known to practice mercy killing. They will examine corpses extensively, scanning the whole body, using the dilated tips of their trunks as organic stethoscopes, conducting an autopsy to determine the cause of death. Although there is often little mystery, the elephant's graveyard being a sentimental myth, serving only to cover up the site of an elephant pogrom. But when elephants are allowed to die in their own time and space, they will sometimes hold up a fallen body as if forming a funeral cortege, and bury their dead by covering them with mud, earth, leaves, and branches, and then return later to draw the tusks, removing them several miles away, or seizing them and shattering them against a nearby tree, as if to cheat traders, as they have done since Herodotus recorded the ruse. A captive elephant will perform the same last rites upon itself. And from a shared aquatic past, the elephant inherits the one quality that Homo sapiens has always arrogantly assumed distinguishes him from the brute beast. An elephant in distress will weep salt tears. In its extremity, the elephant is breeding its ivory away. A female elephant, looking for a mate, will choose a bull with less noticeable tusks, as his fatherly interest in their offspring may have a longer course to run. If animals did not think, they would die. 11 feet tall and weighing 6 tons. The elephant has previously paid little heed to the human scale of things, remaining untroubled by its dismissal as mere animal. A creature with the breath of life, anima, a breeze, then breath, then life. Then soul, anima. The elephant breathes frugally, only 12 times a minute, and it can detect even odorless toxins with the lining of its proboscis. We, on the other hand, are content to breathe in anything, on the off chance it has air in it. The phases of an elephant's life run parallel to the ages of man, with one exception. Through its ability to lower its metabolic rate further than any other mammal, to an almost reptilian level, it has the edge on man for longevity. Its low metabolism enables the elephant to live up to legend and retain its memory for longer, all but petrifying it in a cerebral cement mixer filled with sodium salts and immersing it slowly in giant vascular tanks of protein fixative. Though there may still be many things the elephant would rather forget. Human busybodies, blunting box after box of scalpel blades, have discovered, and ghoulishly rediscovered, that elephants' brains weigh 12 pounds and are 4 times the size of ours. At birth, a human being may weigh 7 pounds. An elephant baby's brain weighs 9. Elephants, as nomads, had no cause to be defensive until men littered the landscape with the upstart products of the human mind, which elephants address with dynamic disdain. When they have a mind to, they will turn over hamburger stands, crush and grind Range Rovers with Luddite zeal, uproot telephone poles, smash down game reserve fencing constructed of steel railroad tracks, cave in buildings, charge at trains dividing their land, tear down traffic signs, and pulverize asphalt roads, originally elephant paths, until they are unusable. Hannibal's tanks become eco-terrorists. To the elephant, our solid and important artifacts are merely the stalking horses of human interference, irritations to be cunningly disposed of, often under cover of darkness, guerrilla-like, months after the immediate affront. As if it believes, like some mosaic godfather, that revenge is a meal best eaten cold. For until men learned to lure the elephant into traps, it was the lord of creation. A fact it may find hard to overlook. First worshipped, then sacrificed. Worshipped because it was the nearest thing on earth to a cloud. Large, grey, wafting gently across the world, and therefore thought suited to support those who seemed to have been touched by the celestial. Decorated as a Brahmin and mounted with a temple to contain them. And when, in the long path of contemplation called Theravada, enlightenment was reached, the state was depicted as the silhouette of an elephant engulfed in flames, an all-embracing presence, a floating ball of light, like the power of an unconstrained mind. The mixture of elephant and man, Ganesha, the remover of obstacles, depicted a union between man and animal that could infuse its followers with courage and prudence. Ganesha could also bestow freedom from bad luck, as animals are seldom observed to put a foot wrong. In the Hindu pantheon, this elephant-headed god, who blended the large with the small, macrocosm with microcosm, was a deity worshipped by the other gods as their teacher, since a glimpse of him brought happiness and made you laugh. In Shinto, Baku, a minute elephant, was placed beside a believer's bed, having the receptive power to siphon off nightmares, leaving the sleeper in peace. And should the Buddha dream of returning, it has been thought that this time round, his favored incarnation would be as an elephant, the strangest manifestation of life. First worshipped, then sacrificed.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Let's return now to Heathcote Williams performing his poem, Sacred Elephant.
A newer, shabbier religion. Man alone, man maximized, made different demands. The elephant's size seemed a challenging affront to man's urge to see himself at the center of things. The elephant was a monster because it was larger than man. The elephant was hunted down and killed. Punily prey to overblown fears, man concocted a temporary conquest of them by killing something larger than himself, crowing over his self-assertion. Free of carnivorous bile, the Pacific elephant was persuaded to bear arms to strike the same terror into the heart of an enemy. As man moved from hunter-gatherer to defensive agriculturalist, the elephant became a casualty of his role-playing and was killed for trampling down his crops. As one tribe overran another, the elephant became the emblem of conquest, its dismembered parts strewn across a continent as trophies to commemorate the penetration of two others. In an epidemic of boy's own atrocity, the teeth of the opposition's exotica were pulled. White tusks from the two dark continents were displayed in suburban homes, each tusk the innocent agent of human slavery, as ton after ton of ivory was marched through mile upon mile of bush. Ever obliging, the elephant was tricked into destroying its own habitat, requisitioned into transporting hardwoods for ships and railroads, bought and sold, used to lend a second-hand sense of majesty to its conquerors, grey panjandrums boxed in tawdry jewel cases strapped to its back. The elephant then became a diverting target for bored plutocrats, diminished further by the patronizing description, big game. Forced at gunpoint to join in the game, it was carved into convoluted knick-knacks, polished into cream-fleshed household gods, concentric balls, one inside another, and then another inside that, to serve as a trifling talking point. The miniaturized finesse of countless drawing-room trumperies, masking the mindlessness with which the raw material was acquired for pistol grips, painstaking baubles, bracelets, for baroque beer mugs, hairbrushes, opulent fans, for spillikins, chess pieces, dice boxes, and knife handles. Kitsch crucifixes, with pale, translucent bodies hanging from them, for the hypnotized attentions of the devout, too transported to see the irony of a scene of torture made of ivory, posing as love. Mannered figurines, bas-relief medallions, perfume flasks, snuff boxes, shuttles, combs, croziers and caskets, pernickety furniture and art deco fittings, fastidious jiggery-pokery, prinked and pampered into important pieces by suede-voiced auctioneers from the residually dominant class, and sold for little fortunes to the luxuriated. Toys for rich grown-ups, impoverished by their dim forgetfulness. For the image of an elephant alive could take them back to the awe of childhood in a trice. Vegetarian watched gravely from the sidelines as man fought with other carnivores for meat, dress rehearsing with animals for making war upon himself. The elephant comes from the old world to the new, to be slaughtered, then snookered in safari parks. A murder victim in the lumber room. An incriminating witness to a buried crime. A look in the eyes, hinting at some prepared testimony, never to be delivered. As if some record lies within of the extent to which its numbers have been ploughed into the fast lane. A stupendous infill as man drives on. Now peered down upon with ungrateful detachment, the elephant is regarded as obsolete, brushed aside, a superfluous enormity, thick-skinned, slothful, clumsy, quaintly lovable, but a ludicrous leftover from a less useful age. An innocent Gulliver, snared, stranded, and hemmed in by an expedient Lilliput.
Sit up. Stand up. Stand on your head. Take a bow.
Look human. Look ridiculous. Or we'll goad you, beat you, prick you. It might be thought that the elephant would be hard to humiliate, but it has humbly allowed people to try. By balancing on bottles, by pushing a pram, by sweeping the street, by mowing lawns, used as a theatrical prop for man to humour himself and his denatured drudgery. By walking round and round in circles, trunk to tail, in an atrophied parody of the technique used to cross rivers in safety, in an interconnected convoy. By tossing a rubber ball up and down and up and down, instead of looping a freshly discovered melon into its mouth. By rearing up on its hind legs as if foraging, only to be greeted with the fruitless rattle of an audience's applause and the snorting recognition of a twisted anthropomorphism as it forms neat gymnastic patterns and pyramids in a bogus pastiche of the group consciousness needed to survive in the wild. Its expansive instinct for play is squeezed into a couple of garish and regimented chinks in the day, the matinee and evening performance. The rest of its time spent chained and boxed in a metal container in the circus ground, to be considered once more an uncouth beast from its odd behavior when caged. Chemically immobilized in the name of pseudoscience, the elephant may, alternatively, awaken in the textured concrete paddock of a zoo, its origins likewise in the seamier side of show business, to be sentenced to life imprisonment for being unusual. Though it has no interest in the homely virtues, it is contained in a so-called elephant house, so that its audience may feel cozier about its domestication. In a last penal colony, facetiously oriental or imperiously brutal and inauthentically rat-infested, besieged by its tsetse flies in human form, it is unable to swat. The elephant moves from one foot to the other, shifting its confined weight repeatedly for the onlooker's education in natural history. Its own powers of observation whittled down to a moribund gaze. Its detention reducing its trunk to an instrument with which to beg. Comic to those who have no need to beg. Occasionally, it will dig a hole in the concrete floor or impotently deface a composition rock in a quest for the complex mineral salts it once needed to feed its mind. It is said that when an elephant is in trouble, even a frog will kick it. One small final indignity The fate of all minorities is for the elephant to be the butt in a rash of seemingly innocent, archly disparaging jokes. How many elephants can you get into a... And the answer could shortly be none. But as they stand silently, imprisoned in a micro theme park, surrounded by insulting paraphernalia for their behavioral enrichment, a foot purposelessly hung in midair, a limp trunk swaying like a pointless pendulum for the amusement of evolution's latest arrival. As they fan their ears to waft phrases of their chemical language towards each other, if there is another, and as a female dips her tail into her vagina, waving it back and forth through the urban air as a scent flag, with regal despond, while her fellow creatures are machine-gunned for tusks as thin as pencils, tweaked from their faces with chainsaws. Without waiting upon the distant concerns of the well-intentioned, an elephant will occasionally go on the rampage, screaming against the obscenity of its fate. To a lone elephant in the zoo, humming in infrasound in the hope of a remote response in its infertile haven, the final truth of its isolation and depletion may sometimes dawn upon it. And it will take the law into its own hands, where it belongs, and pick up its keeper, the immediate agent of its anguish, however benign a tyrant he has been, dispassionately coil its trunk around his neck and crack his head open against the wall of its cell like a coconut, then trample the body underfoot and kick and scrape the remains into its bedding and conceal it, overcome with remorse. After years in human captivity, years of listening to simpering voices through the bars commenting upon its every move, the elephant is required to bow to the expectations of its proprietors. It is consequently destroyed by those whose high-minded notions of justice may merely have their origins in a nervous, haunted fear that the spirits of slaughtered animals, whose corpses propped up the beginnings of their civilization, might return to seek retribution. Such social values being little more than the bonding of simian pack animals, seeking to avoid a lethal squabble while dividing up the carcass of a murdered beast, anxious to seek a compromise, sealed by a mutual glow of self-approval. Consequently, the elephant's sense of justice does not wait upon that of another species, coming as it does from another dispensation, older than human memory. Like the wise child, the elephant is born old, and looking as if already let into the great secret, a sense of the other, which we reject, wanting only a sense of ourselves. And as billiard balls click, making their trivial collisions as the lager flows, who knows what resonates in the ether unresolved? An ivory worker in New York once contracted anthrax while making piano keys, inhaling the dust with its traces of the infection from which the elephant he was reforming had died. As if something marched to a different drummer. And there was a more scrupulous notation than that guiding human hands across ivory keys in heedless elation. Elephants suffer from the same diseases as man and share the same emotions. Love, rage, hate, envy, pride, exhilaration, and despair. Captured and tied up for hours in logging camps, an elephant will commit suicide. Threatened and attacked by overwhelming odds, it will place itself in the line of fire, dying in the cause of a greater good, protecting its fellow creatures or its young. Brought to an end by those to whom it is expedient to think that the elephant has a diminished awareness of death. Killed by those it may regard in turn as rogue humans. If Buddha, Lao Tzu, and the Nazarene were not quite men, then it's just as likely that some elephants were not quite elephants, that long ago, in an elephant dream time, some spiritual counterpart amongst them first took the love of its own kind to an unprecedented extreme, its memory lingering productively in their tribal consciousness, the first altruist. But who are we to know? Fallen out of love with our own kind, persistently killing those who have not, turning them into butchered blobs, carving their bones with mercenary fetishism, until the elephant becomes no more than a memory. It's through an excited compulsion to learn the names of animals that a child first learns to speak. Elephant. The word is pronounced with magnetic recognition. Elephant. A large and germinative being, with whom the child gains a sense of the diversity of its own creature feelings, as yet unformed, sharpens its wits, structures its thought. As big as an elephant, just like an elephant. Through using animals as metaphor, as simile, as allegory, through making sense of the ambiguous borderland of the non-human, through puzzling out a world that could produce elephants, the child gains the notion of another state of play, nearer the roots of creation. In the last decade, 6 out of 10 of the elephants in Africa have been massacred, and the entire population may soon be shoveled contemptuously into the realm of mythology. In the mind's eye of a child, an elephant should now be more accurately depicted as a mutilated corpse. Through mimicry, through games, through trying different molds before maturing and playing with other identities than its own, the child has shaped its world and slowly become human. Once the child grows up, the elephant may be abandoned and forgotten as if it were little more than a frivolous ghost. But until then, it is a touchstone of the child's imagination, one of the first images of the world, alerting the child to its wonder. Pictures and models of animals are latched onto tenaciously. For by entering another domain, the child suspends its small, confined reality, widens the range of the perennial question, who am I? And prepares an escape route from the exhausting centrifugal force of human domination. In that other region, there are creatures larger and stronger than its parents, with a different authority. In collaboration with their distant disposition, a sense of their gathered power, the child's awareness expands before its attention is turned away from the animal to the machine, before its passage is forced into a man-made society with its elephantine surrogates, tower blocks, juggernauts and trampling multinationals, monster markets, jumbo jets and motorways, before it is crushed by the elephantiasis of technology, where there is less and less room for any mammals larger than rats, and where, henceforth, the elephant may exist only in a scratched nature film, a destitute freak in a video zoo. This large link in the chain of being, broken beyond repair. one of the happiest ingredients of a child's psyche, withered and amputated. Elephant! The word will be exclaimed with its familiar magic, but there may be no more elephants. Through the living bodies of animals, we gain an inkling of how things came to be. As their dead bodies pile up, we are merely jostled towards our end. Our fate being joined to theirs in an alliance we cannot bear to acknowledge. In the story of the blind men, each one gave a different description of the elephant, depending upon which part of it he felt. Now they are to be left feeling only each other. Behold now, Behemoth, which I made with thee, chief of the ways of God.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. You just heard a recording of the poem Sacred Elephant, by British poet and playwright Hethcott Williams. Before signing off tonight, I want to let you know of a couple events coming up in Sonoma County that you should mark on your calendars. On Friday, September 19th, the Word Temple Poetry Series held at Copperfields Books will begin the fall 2008 season. Joining me from New York will be poet Lee Slonimsky. He'll be reading from his two books, Pythagoras in Love and Talk Between Leaf and Skin. X.J. Kennedy says of Pythagoras in Love, "Although it is said that there's poetry in mathematics, Lee Slonimsky is among those rare poets who bring the history of mathematics into poetry. In The Last Digit of Pi and other fine sonnets, Slonimsky discovers startling mathematical metaphors in the natural world. His work strikes me as unique in current American poetry." Joining Lee will be Julia B. Levine. She'll be reading from her new book of poems, Ditch Tender. That's Friday, September 19th at 7 o'clock p.m. at Copperfields Books in Montgomery Village. Next, on Sunday, September 20th at 10 a.m., the Sonoma County Book Festival returns to Courthouse Square in Santa Rosa. You don't want to miss this full day of wonderful authors and poets, too, that will be reading on the poetry stage. Some of the poets you can expect to see on the poetry stage at the book festival this year include Judy Gron performing with Anne Carroll, Devorah Major, Lynn Knight, Terry Arrett, Dan Bellum, Jack and Adele Foley, Robert Sword, Stephen Kessler, and David Smith Ferry. That's just some of the poets that will be on the poetry stage Saturday, September 20th in Courthouse Square. So please mark your calendars Friday, September 19th at 7 p.m. Copperfields Books in Montgomery Village will be kicking off the fall season of the Word Temple Poetry Series. The next day, Saturday, September 20th at 10 a.m., the Sonoma County Book Festival returns to Courthouse Square in Santa Rosa. I look forward to seeing you there. I opened tonight's show with a song by South African singer Miriam Makeba. Let's go out now with a song by another South African, Hugh Masekela.
Sambonani we madoda hayi ngena ngena. Sambonani we madoda hawu hawu.
gena gena he he. Gonkosa gena gena. Gonkosa gena gena. Sambonani wematota hai gena gena. Sambonani wematota hau hau gena gena. Gonkosa gena gena. Gonkosa gena gena.